All right, well, welcome everyone to our first Pixar Roundtable. Basically, I am joined with a few fellow Pixar Weekly Tier fans, and we're just going to talk Pixar with you guys tonight. We're going to talk everything from history to movies to films to things that we may think the future may hold for Pixar and everything in between. So just so you know, we may have some spoilers. So if there's any Pixar films that you haven't seen just yet and you're trying to remain spoiler free, we will be talking about some movies later. So just kind of beware. We will put a little spoiler alert before we get to that movie section, though. So how we're going to do this is I am joined tonight by Karina, Liberty, also Jill, Lee, and Tara. And so each of them are going to take ownership and talk about a certain aspect of this. So we're going to do kind of a round table, just like we did for Star Wars and then also most recently Marvel. So to kind of warm everybody up and to kind of introduce the cast that we have with us this evening, we're going to talk about our Pixar story. And basically, that's just going to be a brief explanation about what Pixar means to us. I can go first. Pixar, honestly, this is going to be so brief, you're going to laugh at me, but Pixar to me, when I think of Pixar, is it just every movie I watch from that studio is like a hug. It's like a hug to my heart. They do such a great job of really developing the characters and really making you fall for them. Sometimes even in like the first 10 minutes of the film, I'm looking at you. You pulled at my heartstrings there. But yeah, it's just like a hug to my heart. I just can't help but feel wonderful and smile when I watch them. So let's move. Lee, let's have you talk about what your Pixar story is.
I think I like Pixar because it's about flawed people or toys or whatever they are, and they always manage to overcome their problems and their issues, whatever's going on, to do something positive. It's the same reason I like Disney, that in general, what Disney does is offer hope that things can be like they should be, as opposed to, you know, how things are. And Pixar does that too. Pixar's a little better at having their characters have some serious flaws and able to overcome those flaws and to do something positive for other people or toys or monsters or whatever they are. So they are able to express that in a really good way. And it is all about story most of the time. Pixar does a real good job of building a story that is going to be timeless. Toy Story doesn't have anywhere near the animation level as, the Soul or something that's newer. But the story still holds up really well. And so that's really what I like about it.
Awesome. What about for you, Karina?
Pixar's pretty important to me because it actually reminds me of my late grandma. I grew up being babysat by her when my parents would go to work, and every day we would watch Toy Story. Like, I probably bored her to death watching this movie, but we'd watch it in English, in Spanish, because she spoke Spanish. And it was just kind of our love language. Even as I grew up, that was just kind of our go-to movie. So I always think of her when I watch Pixar movies.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. For you, Tara.
My love of Pixar started way back in 1997. That was my first introduction to Pixar with Jerry's Game, with the old Jerry character short, the little short that where he's playing chess against himself. I was 16 and my high school had the opportunity for some students to be selected to attend a film festival that was based all about animation collected from around the world in my hometown. And I had never heard of Pixar before that. And when I saw that, I was just so kind of really drawn in, like Lee said, to the story, you know, to this idea of, at first I thought Jerry was twins, and then it started to become like, I became aware of the fact that he was playing against himself and that this is kind of something that he regularly does. And it reminded me a lot of so many people who take the opportunity to like challenge themselves in their later years regardless of like whether there's somebody else to compete about, it's about competing against themselves and kind of bettering themselves and improving themselves, and how even in defeating himself, like the part of him that was defeated was like a good sport about it. And I kind of really loved that story, and the animation was incredible. So instantly, like I fell in love with them. And then when Toy Story came out, that was like a childhood dream, you know, the idea that your toys are coming to life and they have their own lives and their own like social dynamic and their own hierarchies, all the things that when you're a kid, you imagine that these relationships occur, and then you kind of lose that wonder, that magic, as you get older. And I think things like Disney and Pixar help to kind of reinvigorate the child within us, but also like they're really good at speaking to not just the child within the adult, but also like to the children themselves. So they really have like this greater appeal. And like Lee said, like they do kind of tackle those things that are maybe more complex that kids aren't going to get, but it's like, that's why I can watch it years later and see a whole different aspect of that story and of those characters and like different dynamics that I didn't see before. So it really is timeless to me. And I think Jerry was my hook.
That was such a great short. I like distinctly remember the first time I watched that too. And like you said, being kind of confused, like what's happening, and then kind of like understanding it the more you watched it. So yeah, that's great. How about for you, Jill?
Well, I am kind of like you with the hug thing, but I actually, whenever I watch like a Pixar movie now, it actually sends me back to when my children were younger, and it just is very comforting to me. When Lee was saying that that a lot of the characters have flaws and that they find a way to make that not a super negative thing, to kind of come out of it. Mm-hmm. And there's always, I don't know, it's always hope and positivity towards, you know, somewhere in the movies. That's one of the things that I adore about Pixar. And I think the animation's spectacular. Like at night, I've had a really stressful teaching day sometimes, especially teaching first grade for so many years. Being around that age child, actually, that all those movies were really comforting to me. So I can just put one on and it's just all the stress just drained. So that's me.
Oh, that's awesome. I like that. And finally, Liberty, what is your Pixar story?
Oh, wow. I definitely resonate with a lot of what was said. I believe that what's really special is that, for one, the company like fully formed was founded the year I was born. So that's cool. I believe Tin Toy, that movie or that short film, was the first like short Pixar short that I actually watched a few years later as a young child. And I probably revisited that short film pretty often. Like it was sort of like that comfort film whenever you wanted, like before a nap or something, or just something to really like soothe you and calm you down. That was my go-to short film. And then then years later, I remember the first like feature film, Pixar feature film, that I really admired in terms of its art, design, and animation, like for the very first time, was A Bug's Life. And I think that was the first time that I noticed like a transition from the Toy Story like animation to this really awesome, just amazing like technological advance, where they did a lot of research to just like capture the translucence, you know, that grass gives off, and like having this insect eye view of, you know, this hill out in the field. And so to be able to like really appreciate that as a preteen, and just constantly, again, rewatch that movie several times, like in the afternoon after school, was really cool. And that really like made me just really excited for like the future films to come. So I think that's really where it started, though, was with that Tin Toy short, just being really like captured by the baby and just the little, you know, the story of that.
Awesome. Great answers all around. I sensed a lot of similar themes. So obviously Pixar is interesting how it just touches your soul, and it's cool that it's comforting for some. It helps bring back great memories and memories with loved ones for others. It's just awesome. Well, to kind of kick off the rest of our discussion for the roundtable, what's the best place to start? Well, of course, the beginning. So the history section will be discussed by our friend Lee. So take it away, Lee.
Okay. What I was going to talk about basically is just where Pixar came from and how the company evolved, because it was originally a different thing and then it became Pixar over time. What it started with is there is a New York Institute of Technology. I don't know if it still existed, but it existed in the 70s. That was founded by Alexander Shore. And his thing was he wanted to streamline the animation process. He had used animation to teach complex math to people at this institute. And he wanted to basically streamline it because it's so difficult to do hand-drawn animation. So that was his goal, and to make an animated short cartoon. I don't believe he wanted to do a feature at first, but that's what he was shooting for. Now, he hired Ed Catmull, who eventually will go on to be the founder of Pixar later. And he hired him. He's a PhD from Utah. He's very young at this point. And he will do the first animation that is computer animation of a hand and a face. You can see that on YouTube if you want to look it up. And it was used in a movie called Future World, which was the sequel to Westworld, which you may have heard of as a TV show now, but originally was a show in the early 70s that was similar to the TV show. And so that's how it started. It was this concept that they wanted to streamline animation. George Lucas hired Ed Catmull and another PhD from NYIT. His name was Alvy Ray Smith. They created the Pixar computer. That's where the name of the company comes from, and the RenderMan program. And their first thing that they did was in the Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, there was a Genesis simulation in that. And if you watch the movie, again, you can see this on YouTube. It shows how the Genesis program, I'm not going to get into what that is, but basically it's the first time that they use a computer generated graphic. Now, they could not put it on the film directly. They had to film it from a computer. So this is going to be an issue for a while that they can't actually, they're still using film. And so it's not digital. And so they're filming things on a computer. Their work was copied or inspired. Well, copied is maybe a little harsh, but Tron also did the same thing in 1982. And that movie's a Disney movie, and you may have seen that. And it's got some computer graphics in it too. So the 1982 is the first time they actually use it in a film that isn't... you know, real simplistic stuff. Now, they did have to film directly from a screen, like I said. In 1983, John Lasseter was fired from Disney. He was trying to get the Brave Little Toaster, which is a cartoon that somebody eventually made, as a CGI film. He was inspired by Tron to do that. Catmull hired him as the first Lucasfilms animator in order to get someone that could draw, because he didn't have that much drawing ability. And so Lasseter's first short was The Adventures of Andre and Wally B, which is on Disney Plus. It was in 1984, and it was a huge advance for movement and that type of thing. In 1985, he created a knight that's in a movie called Young Sherlock Holmes. I don't know if anyone's seen that. I have. It was a stained glass window that moved, and that was a CGI. That was the first time that they did a lot of color for CGI, and that was something that he did for that movie. The first short that's really famous that he created was Luxo Jr. That's where the lamp comes from. That was in 1986. It was nominated. Didn't win for the Oscar, but it was nominated for an Oscar. And then Pixar splits off at this point because they don't need it anymore for Lucasfilm. He's going to use some of their stuff later for the prequels for Star Wars, but he doesn't feel like he needs the company anymore. So he basically is going to they're going to split off. It's founded by Ed Catmull and the guy that came with him from the other place, Alvy Ray Smith. And the person that provided financing that was, of course, Steve Jobs. And so he technically owns the company at first. Then in 1988, they won the first Pixar short. It was Tin Toy, which if you've seen it is terrifying. It has a baby in it, and it's the baby is at the time, I'm sure, was wonderful. Right now, it doesn't look so good. But definitely, it was a big advance in terms of human animation. The first time they tried that, and it was good for the time. Obviously, now they've improved. At this point, they begin to focus more on developing programs and computers. They develop a CAPS, computer animation production system for Disney. We don't think of it, but The Little Mermaid was actually animated in a traditional way. The first movie to use this is The Rescuers Down Under. And they do this to streamline the ink and paint process. Later on, they'll use it for things like animated films like Beauty and the Beast, the ballroom scene, and also just to replace the ink and paint, the physical painting of the cells. Pixar is losing money at this point because they're focusing on this hardware and not everybody can buy it. It's quite expensive. And they survive by making commercials. They made a Tarzan Listerine commercial and some other commercials. So they did that for a while. In 1991, Disney is impressed by Tintoy. They try to rehire Lasseter as a director. He stays at Pixar. And so they make a deal with Disney, Pixar does, to create the first community animated film, which is eventually going to be Toy Story. And that's when they really take off, is when they start to make full-length movies. They have a series of movies from 1995 to 2004 that are hits. And basically every movie, the animation gets a little better. And they just do better and better over that time period. This is Toy Story, A Bug's Life. And then they start coming out a little bit closer together about every 2 years. Toy Story 2, Monsters Incorporated, Finding Nemo, and The Incredibles. At this point, they have all kinds of problems with Disney because Disney doesn't take them seriously at first. They don't have any toys. I remember this when my kids were little. They didn't have any toys. My kids wanted the Buzz Lightyear and the Woody toy, and then later Jesse. And they didn't produce very many toys at first. They didn't do a very good job of that. And then they just don't take it seriously. And Pixar resents this, and they're not getting as much money as they feel like they deserve. They nearly split from Disney and go to another studio. Bob Iger at that point buys Pixar. Michael Eisner, when he left, he buys Pixar and they go on. They have a series of movies after that that are not as successful, but are definitely successful to a degree. There's Cars, Ratatouille, WALL-E, and Up, and then Toy Story 3. And those movies are successful. They're not quite as successful or as critically acclaimed as the movies that they originally made, but there's some movies in there that are huge accomplishments. I think Up is probably the best of those, but that's my opinion. Then they are kind of going to have a time period where things don't go as well. They make Cars 2, which is generally considered not their best movie, Brave, which was not well received, Monsters University. Then they make Inside Out, which was very well received. And then they make The Good Dinosaur, which wasn't. So there's this time period basically from about 2011 to about 2015 where they don't do quite as well. They start to do a little better with Finding Dory in 2016. And then they go back to kind of doing the same kind of thing where they get celebrated. Cars 3 was pretty well received. Coco was very well received. Incredibles 2 was... people liked it. They didn't consider it as good as Incredibles, but they liked it. Toy Story 4 was generally well received. Onward and Soul, and then Luca is their next film. And so generally, they seem to have gone back to having original films, and they seem to pretty much be on a path to continue to be successful. And in general, even movies like Cars 2 have made money. And so they haven't ever not been successful, but they have definitely had kind of an up and down thing through the years. During this time period, they also make a lot of shorts. I'm not going to get into all those. There's a lot. That is a thing that is a signature of them, that they always have a short in front of the film. And Disney eventually copies that. They had done that in the 40s and 50s. And then they went back to doing it where they have shorts in front of films. And Pixar is the one that got Disney to do that. So that's pretty much it from where they came from.
Wow, that was impressive. That was however many years of history squished down into just a handful of minutes. Yeah, I am impressed.
Well, we didn't want to bore everybody too much. So,
if you want kind of more information on the negotiations when Disney bought Pixar, I think I've said this before, that book called A Ride of a Lifetime with Michael or Bob Iger, it's got a really good detailed kind of what happened, and it's really, really interesting.
Yeah, I've read it. There's another book called Disney Wars that details more about why they fell apart. And I've read the book that you're talking about with Iger, and I thought it was excellent that he explained why he did what he did and how he did it.
Right.
And so, yeah, I thought it was very well done. And it's a very good audio book, too. He reads part of it. And so, I would highly recommend those books to understand why the whole thing with Disney really fell apart. It didn't fall apart, but almost. And so... he covers that. And he had a really good relationship with Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs was a difficult man. And he had a good relationship with him. And And then, of course, Steve Jobs got really sick and died eventually of pancreatic cancer. And so that he talks about that too. So there's, yeah, it's a very good book. And I would, yeah, definitely recommend it.
Awesome.
I wanted to bring up that I like that you talked about that they developed their own computer, because I think as somebody who, you know, grew up with them, I didn't find that out until recently. You know, I wasn't aware that they had kind of like developed their own technology. I knew that they were working on their, you know, kind of proprietary software, et cetera, but like actually developing hardware was news to me. And right now at the Museum of Science in Boston, they're doing the Science of Pixar exhibit. They have a whole website devoted to it. And one of the things that they have there is one of the original Pixar computers. So it was kind of neat for me to see that there was something. I just saw, okay, Pixar computer. And, you know, I assume that this was something that kind of came later in their development, but to like to hear that that was actually kind of at the forefront of their development and kind of what made them stand out as being more unique in the film industry, I think was really interesting to me.
Yeah, they're the ones, the reason we have computer animation, really. I mean, because they sold their technology to other companies. That's what they did for a while. So since they did that, there wasn't anybody else that was doing it. They didn't know how to do it. And so they pretty much established it. Now other people, of course, do it now. Everybody does it now. But they probably have developed their own kind of thing. But in terms of it starting, Pixar was definitely the reason that it started. And they pretty much created their own competition, including Disney for a while. Disney will compete with them briefly, but they also, you know, all the other imagination, all those other companies that do this, they got their technology from Pixar initially.
Tara, do you have a link, or maybe can you give us a little more information so we can share how, if Weekly Tears want to see this exhibit that you just described, which sounds amazing, kind of we can point them in the right direction and we'll include that in the show notes for this.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, Jill, I'm very excited for your next thing, because, of course, this is what everybody loves so much about Pixar is the movies. So I would love to hear what your top three Pixar favorite films are, which good luck picking just three. And also just why they're so meaningful for you.
Well, it was really difficult to choose which three. OK, so I actually started with number three. And I love Monsters, Inc. And part of the reason I love Monsters, Inc. is because I think when you're younger, a lot of kids have an irrational thought that there's something in their closet. And so I thought it was a great way to show, to just deal with that whole thought process that kids have and make it so it was more fun and more, you know, like it actually ends up being fine kind of thing. And I love all the characters in it. And I that's where Pixar is so creative, because the characters were also different. So for me, because I had an irrational fear of things in the closet, I also feel like my boys did too. You know, you do that thing where you think there's something in the closet that's going to come out. So you run, like, try to turn off the light and run and jump into your bed kind of thing. Well, I just thought that the whole Monsters, Inc. thing was really good. So that was my number three.
Nice.
My number two was Toy Story. And number one, as an adult, I think it brought not only things that kids like to see, but adults like to see. And the humor was adult humor in a lot of places. I think there's this one. Oh, when Mr. Potato Head he's actually trying to make a joke, and he takes off his lips and he touches his bottom. Anyway, things that kids really wouldn't get, but adults would. And then all the toys were a lot of toys from when I was a child. You know, when my kids were a child, this Mr. Spell, there's Slinky Dog. There's Mr. Potato Head, which, you know, a long time ago, Mr. Potato Head was a real potato, but then the potatoes got so rotten that they had to change it to plastic, you know, make plastic ones.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, all those things were, but I think the biggest thing was just as an adult being able to watch it and also enjoy it with your kids because there's humor that you would grasp as well. And every time I watch, it doesn't matter which Toy Story, every single time I cry at the end, always, because I'm thinking back to when my kids were little. So that was my number two. And my number one was Cars. And part of the reason why I like Cars was I hadn't gone to Disneyland in 50 years. So I lived and grew up in Southern California, and then we moved. And so I didn't go back for 50 years. And when I went back, I went over to California Adventure, and, you know, there's Cars Land, and I'm like, oh, this is great, you know, but I didn't really have any context to understand why they did this area in California Adventure. So we go, and finally somebody says, well, it's kind of, connected to the Cars movie. And I have three boys, so I'm like, oh, I didn't really watch the Cars movie when they watched it. So then when I went home, I watched the movie, and I'm like, oh my gosh, everything is so clear now. I had the context and I could really relate to it. So anyway, so then the backstory before I talk about the Cars movie is that my neighbor, when I lived in Nebraska, my neighbor was Larry the Cable Guy, but I didn't know it was Larry the Cable Guy at the time. So I'd gone back for a 40-year reunion, and I said, literally, he was my next door neighbor. And I said, how come they changed the name of the street to Danny Whitney Lane? And the people in my class, because there were only 44 people in my class, they said, it's Larry the Cable Guy. And I said, no, it's not. They said, yes, Larry the Cable, that's who that is. And so I kind of have a connection with all of that. And so I can watch that movie and I can totally relate, or not relate, but it always makes me feel so good in the part of the movie when he and Sally are driving, going out for the drive, and they go through the leaves, and the leaves, you know, hit him, his headlights and stuff, and he's all muddy. And then they come out and there's that waterfall, and then the music just is so serene, and so, you know, it builds, and then it's just beautiful. That whole thing is just really beautiful to me. So that's my number one. But I do have a quick honorable mention, which is Coco. And the reason I like Coco is teaching younger children, especially, I'm a dual language teacher, so teaching them and having Pixar be able to bring the whole idea of death into a place where kids could kind of understand some of it and be not so frightened of it was really something that I thought was really strong and positive. And yes, so that's my honorable mention.
Such great movies. Congratulations. I would not have been able to limit myself to three plus an honorable mention. So congratulations on that. But such great reasoning for why each one means, you know, it made your list and has such deep, beautiful meaning for each one. And so very different reasons for each too. That's great.
I have to say, Jill, I'm right there with you when it comes to Cars. I had no interest in watching that series at all. My nephew was super into it, but he was six. So, you know, I didn't have any interest at all until I went to DCA. I had that same experience. I was like, okay, this all looks really amazing, but I didn't really have the context. So it was like, okay, this is really neat, but I'm not kind of getting what the like fan connection is. I wasn't getting that warm and fuzzy that mm-hmm. I normally do when I visit, you know, Disney, when I visit Disneyland or Disney California. So I went back and watched the movies too. And I had that same kind of wow moment. And for me now, every time I'm on Radiator Springs Racers and I go by, you know, they take that slow stroll right by the waterfall with uh-huh. the music, like you set, oh my God, my heart just wells up and I get a little teary eyed and I'm like, I can't believe I'm almost crying on uh-huh. a roller coaster, you know, and it's not from fear. It's from joy. You know, it really, it brings that. I love that.
It, you know, we need to take a minute and give some much needed appreciation, because Radiator Springs Racers is just such an unbelievable attraction. The way that they use the animatronics, and I mean, you are just fully in that world, and you were brought into that world before you even got into the queue, because they brought you in when you stepped foot on the lovely asphalt lane and walked into town. It's just incredible. Liberty or Karina, do you guys have a favorite, either of you have a favorite part or something that every time you do Radiator Springs Racers is just a like, oh, moment for you?
Yeah, as Tara was talking right now, I was like just envisioning myself in the racers. And I remember saying on our last interview, you asked about my favorite attraction. I think I always go back to Cars Land and Radiator Springs because of how amazing it is at night. I think it's one thing to be immersed during the day and to walk through, go to Flo's V8, Cozy Cone, and it's another to experience that with all of the neon lights and the music playing at nighttime, and then getting on that attraction at night is just incredible. So that definitely is one of my favorite attractions for sure.
Yeah. And just the ambiance itself, like I have photos around Radiator Springs Racers where out of context, you might not even realize you're at a theme park. And that is amazing to me. And yeah, that's one of my favorite rides in California Adventure as well. I remember, I think it was back in high school maybe, when it was really popular and brand new. And one of the first things we would do, I had an annual pass, and me and my best friend would go. And the first thing we did was run there and hope we could get a fast pass. 9 times out of 10, you couldn't. But that made every ride that much more special when we could finally get on it. So yeah, that one holds a special place in my heart for sure.
It's just such a beautiful use of thrill ride versus like and dark ride, and just all the feels. So well done. Well, moving on and still continuing our discussion about films, Liberty, how about you talk to us about some of the Academy Award-winning films? Because as Lee was telling us before, Pixar has had some incredible, incredible films from the beginning and recently, too.
Absolutely. I'm happy to discuss. So I think we definitely want to start with the history of the Academy Awards and the animated feature category. It was recent. So the idea of the Oscars nominating animated feature films, that wasn't a popular decision or opinion, because they were just at that time simply just far too too little produced to justify like the consideration of one. So instead, the Academy, they basically would just bestow special exceptional productions. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs being one of them in 1938, received the Special Achievement Academy Award, as well as Who Framed Roger Rabbit in 1988. So there are all these like specialized awards, but not necessarily like the prominence of an animated feature category or award. And so that really started with the nomination in 2002, the first Oscars at the 74th Academy Awards, it was awarded to Shrek. It was around that time that the DreamWorks Animation production company, which was essentially founded by the former Disney executive, Jeffrey Katzenberg. And a lot of this information, again, is on all these great documentaries on Disney Plus. He created an increase of film releases, and they fast-tracked a number of really popular animated films. And so with that, there was this talk about putting that category back on and considering it for, an award. And so the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature was given out at the 74th Academy Awards. They awarded Shrek. And then fast-track to now, we're at 11 Academy Awards for Pixar. And that's just for their feature films. There are a total of about, I believe, 16 wins altogether. And that list actually includes short films, awards for special achievements for short films, for sound editing and things like that. With the most recent win in 2019 with Toy Story 4 for Best Animated Feature. And Because Soul recently, last month, just won a Golden Globe for Best Animated Feature. That's typically an award show that forecasts the winners for the Oscars. And so there's really a lot of high hopes for Soul, directed by Pete Docter and Kent Powers, for that movie to take another win as well for Best Animated Feature this upcoming year. Pixar has just revolutionized the world of animation. And I think it's safe to say that their movies, as we've all talked about here earlier, they're just rooted in a lot of depth, and it just reflect a lot of the breadth of what animation can do and will do, especially as we take on more like technologically advanced and computer graphics, as we take those and then align it with amazing storytelling. And so I think not only have those movies that have won Oscar films, have they paved the way for future indie animation films as well, but they've also paved the way for really great storytelling from these movies. Behind the production, there are awesome innovators. And I wanted to just touch on the visual innovation and unique stories of these movies, that it's so significant that they're grounded in the lives of Pixar creatives themselves. And I do want to just mention two very significant films, Coco being one of them. It was co-directed by Adrian Molina and Lee Unkrich. But for example, Adrian Molina comes from a multi-generational family where he was raised with aunts, uncles, grandparents in the same house. And to be able to see the beauty in seeing different languages, different cultural tendencies really blend together to make this sort of beautiful mess, that was sort of the inspiration in writing Coco and directing Coco. And he's talked about it in a number of interviews as that being just one of the reasons why he was able to really produce such beautiful work. So much research goes into it. If you browse Disney Plus documentaries, there are a ton of recently new and also old documentaries on Pixar production, and also a deeper look into the lives of Pixar creatives and Pixar staff. And I've learned a lot about the research that they do and how they recruit cultural consultants to make sure that they're really telling a story that is accurate, especially when it involves other cultures, because they want to make sure that they're inclusive and that they are doing their best to tell a story. And ultimately, with all of these things in mind, there is a universal message that somehow touches at, or pulls at our heartstrings. And what's really interesting is that at the end of the day, it's still a kids' movie. And that is why I think they've been so successful, is because that although Pixar films have really unpacked some complex emotions, to this idea or this topic of death, to this topic of job loss and having to move to another city and start over with Inside Out, or even this topic of growing up and outgrowing some things like toys, I think that at the end of the day, they're still kids' films, but they really bring in adult audiences through that storytelling and through those complex emotions that are sort of woven into really engaging computer graphics and images. So I think that is why they've stood out for so long, and they've been able to, the accolades are well-deserving, with 17 wins going on, possibly more as they continue. And then the other piece is just behind these films are such amazing, innovative creatives who take the time to not only ground the story in their own personal lives, but also the lives of the people they're wanting to represent in the stories by doing the research and recruiting consultants, cultural consultants, to make sure that they're telling the story to the best of their ability and that it's accurate and really inclusive.
That's awesome. That's so beautiful. And it is, I'm glad that you did a shout out to all of the different documentaries and the different little behind the scene things that have come to Disney Plus recently, because to me, like, that is what makes Disney Plus just that much better than all the competition. Yes, of course, I love like click of the button access to all my favorite Disney movies, but the behind the scenes content that they have been able to create and put out through that platform is just amazing. So thank you so much, liberty for all of that. And I do love, I didn't know about Coco. I haven't seen that documentary yet that talks about how the director like really pulled from personal experience. And I think that's really just what makes Pixar, you know, just that much better.
Just a comment real quick on good job, Liberty, explaining the whole Oscar thing, because
thank you.
I remember when Shrek won, I was really act because my kids really liked Monsters Incorporated. They were five and six at that point. And so they were into it. They were that for Halloween. And I was just thinking, oh, Monsters is going to roll over Shrek. And it didn't. And so, and I was just really not happy. So although Shrek is not a bad movie, at the time, I thought it was the most worst movie ever, but I got over it, but it definitely was, I was really rooting for Monsters Incorporated. And that's during the time where every Pixar movie was great. And so they had done movies that would have won before that, obviously. And so, and they didn't, Beauty and Beast was nominated, but they hadn't nominated any Pixar movies yet. So, for Best Picture, but it definitely was, that was interesting that you brought that up. So that was cool.
Yeah, of course.
I appreciate that you spoke to how the artists kind of use their experiences in their own lives as an inspiration for their story or something to model their stories on. Because I think that we see that in Soul, in, you know, the Black American experience is really a lot of the inspiration behind the many characters and the role that African Americans have played in American culture and the jazz movement and kind of bringing that forward and everything that it has developed into. So it was really kind of lovely to hear how that's an ongoing thing that like the many different artists have invigorated these stories or shaped these stories around their own experiences. And I think also that was the case with Onward, right? Mm-hmm. Where the story artist was really kind of giving a voice to his own experience of losing his father at a young age. And I mean, the movie itself is like a tearjerker every time. Mm-hmm. Even though I tell myself at the beginning, like, I'm not going to cry this time. I've seen this movie like three times. I still end up in, at the end, I'm still tearing up when the sun comes up. I'm like, no, don't go, but I think that, when I saw the Disney Plus behind the scenes and I'm listening to the artist talk about how this relates to his experience, it was like, oh my God, tears from the moment he was like, I also lost my dad. It was like, oh no, it really hit me how personal that story was and how brave these artists are to share that with such a wide audience and to really kind of not just put themselves out there, but to understand that these emotions, to speak to Lee's point earlier, that these are something that we, you know, we are all challenged with at different points in our lives and we all overcome. Even if the ways in which we come to those emotions aren't the same, that, you know, we all experience loss over our lives and we all experience joy and we all experience, you know, wondering what the meaning of our life is and all of those kind of bigger picture things. You know, what you said about like they're still children's films. I think that really speaks to kind of what we've touched on earlier was the fact that it's really digestible for kids.
Yeah.
Even these bigger, very like adult concepts are very often like something that they can relate to now or that will help them kind of form the way to relate to emotions as they get older and those things start happening more in their lives.
Yeah. The second film I was actually going to touch on, but I'll just briefly, because I know we're at time. I was going to mention really briefly about Pete Docter's sort of journey to create Soul and co-direct it with Kemp Powers. He felt like there was so much box office success with Inside Out, another film that he directed. So it's like, where do I go from here? What next? And again, it comes from his own personal reflection and journey to figure out what happens like in the before life and just being also someone who is a student himself studying different religions and the cultural, you know, applications with that topic. That's such a convoluted topic for some, and to have to be able to put that into a children's movie, animate it, just animate that concept is really, it's just really a beautiful thing. And so again, it started from these like really high, you know, like high level questions that then they kind of narrow it down and do the research and think about how can they make it a tangible, like bite-sized manageable piece for kids. And it ends up being like these cute characters that just kind of bounce around in this before life scene or this before life environment. So yeah, I think I agree. I think it's really an amazing thing that they're doing with these films.
So to kind of even dive a little bit further into that, Tara, how about you go ahead and you start on your section that's kind of more about like the character development, art development, and then just, you know, talking more about how the stories resonate with everyone.
Right. So I really wanted to kind of speak to the way that characters are developed in the Pixar series that makes it unique, especially in, you know, in contrast to what Disney has done over the years. And a really great example of that is when we look at villains. So when we focus on villains, we'll see that very often in the original stories with Snow White and Cinderella, there's like a very clear, distinct villain who is considered evil with little to no morality or like redeemable values. And what I see as a thread, and you know, please interject as you agree or disagree with me, but what I see is an ongoing thread throughout these films that Pixar has created is there's very rarely a distinct character that is like 100% villainous. Many oftentimes we see that the main characters in films, in their films, either empathize with or somehow like come to sympathize with the character in a way that they show them, you know, what, like to let go of their anger or their fear or all of those things. And oftentimes we've seen that the main characters are mistaken. A perfect example of that is in Toy Story 4, where, you know, Dolly was the kind of evil character initially, just trying to rip out, or I'm sorry, not Dolly, but
Gabby.
Yes. Gabby was the kind of evil character where she was trying to, you know, she wanted to get Woody's voice box and it was all about her. But then he came to understand that she was this sad, you know, kind of abandoned little girl who was just looking for the resources that she needed in order to be loved the way that he had been so fortunate to experience that love for so many years under Andy. He came to empathize with her, like, oh my gosh, see it from her point of view. And I think that that's something that we rarely, if ever, would see in a traditional Disney film. You know, so for them to kind of say, like, villains are not pure evil, that they have motivations, they have a humanity, they have another side to them. And if we take a look deep enough, we may actually be able to find our shared humanity between ourselves and that so-called villain. I think that that is very interesting. I was looking at fandoms. Fandom has if you're not familiar with fandom, it is a kind of social media type service, similar to like Wikipedia, but they have separate little kind of wiki sites based off of different types of fandoms, like for instance, Disney or Pixar. They have one that's called Wikidpedia, which I absolutely love because it's all Disney villains. In there, they list 30 individual quote unquote villains in Pixar films. And many of those are small characters like the librarian in Monsters University, you know, where she kind of played a villainous role, but was she really evil? No. You know, she was just trying to do her job and keep that library quiet. And she didn't really mean any malice. But one thing that I found interesting was that Nerdlist has a listing of their top 18 Pixar villains. And I would almost argue that some of these characters are not actual traditional villains. At the bottom of their list was like Professor Z from Cars 2, you know, the evil kind of German car who is like out to, you know, he's a part of this like international kind of covert spy network. And he's kind of that very baseless evil character. But then they really kind of pull out, and their top three included like Sid from Toy Story, who I would argue is one of the first traditional villains in the Pixar series, because we never see any kind of empathy towards him. And in later films, we do see a lot of empathy towards those main villainous characters. But this is one character that he just comes in as this really like destructive, harmful to his little sister, little boy. And then he kind of gets his comeuppance, you know, but the toys never really kind of try to examine, you know, why he is the character that he is, like why, as Lisa mentions, like why he is the bully that he is, you know, what makes a bully and where does that come from? And I think that Pixar has, over their years of story development, that they have also try to kind of dig into that empathetic side of their characters, so that when we get to, you know, Gabby later, we see that she may seem like a bully from the outside, but she is actually a very like hurt character, a very hurt individual who is acting out of that pain. And the same thing with Lotso Hugging Bear. I mean, gosh, that guy seemed like really vicious when he was trying to shove them down that trash chute, you know, but you go back and you see his backstory and you see that he is also a hurt, abandoned, very broken character who is acting out of fear. He's acting out of fear of losing the people around him, losing his family, losing his stability, all of those things. And ultimately being replaced, that he is someone who doesn't necessarily like have the individuality that's required in order for him to somehow sustain relationships. And there's a moment where we feel like maybe he's starting to see that he can be vulnerable with other characters, that he can, you know, go back to that. And he kind of at the last minute makes a decision of like, no, I'm going to reject that idea and I'm going to kind of stay in this fear. And we see how that plays out. The final character that they mention as their number one, and I would ask all of you three to consider what what is your top three villains, is Syndrome. So Syndrome in The Incredibles, again, like we already see from the beginning of that film that he is not purely an evil character, you know, that he wants to do good. And when he's a young boy, he has this dream of aspiring to be a superhero, like his personal hero, like his mentor. And he's, you know, worked hard and to develop his technology. And like, he's put so much effort into this dream of wanting to be the sidekick, not even like the hero himself, in the forefront and, you know, at the head of this team, but he really says, I just want to be there to help you help other people, which I think is an admirable thing. And then we see how that very self-centered rejection by our hero turns his relationship with heroes and in a way that becomes very, very dark and disturbed. And ultimately it's that he wants to live out this childhood dream, you know, of being the hero to everyone else, of being able to save everyone else. And because of the rejection that he got from his mentor, he he feels that the only way to do this is to become both the biggest threat and the biggest hero at the same time, to become his own hero. And he's also like pretty much an ordinary guy. You know, he develops everything out of tech. He's not born with super abilities like many of the other superheroes in that Incredibles world. And so he strives to kind of make himself an equal. And it just takes him down this really horrible path. But we see our hero in Mr. Incredible apologizing to him. You know, we see that empathy again come up in looking at what effect do we have on each other? How can the words that we say, how can the things that we do affect people, and really taking responsibility and ownership for that? And I think that those are wonderful lessons for kids, but also a good reminder to us as adults. And I think really goes to the heart of the beauty of Pixar, and that they really try to address things from multiple sides. Another thing is, I would argue that they have a lot of what I would call pseudo villains in films. And this is something where there's not a character that embodies a particular evilness, but it's really the main characters themselves kind of fighting their internal selves. So we see this in Inside Out, obviously. Like, we're seeing that Joy is a part of our little girl, but at the same time, Joy herself has fear. We see that over and over again, that this character that is supposed to embody all joy and all wonderfulness, and, you know, is literally named by her emotion, is actually fearful of loss. She's fearful of losing areas, of villages, of towns, of these memories that have been created. And she's fearful of the emotion fear taking over.
So with all these different villains, I love that you started with villains, because who doesn't love a good Disney villain and Pixar villain, right? And that's, I love your thought. I've never thought of Joy as being a pseudo villain, but you're right. But the thing that like is just really like, right, we're thinking about like Pixar as a whole and all of this. How do these very complex characters, so villains that we like, right, traditionally villains are bad, heroes are good, but Pixar's blurring the lines here. So how does that then go into the bigger picture of how does, you know, the heart of Pixar films and what makes Pixar Pixar?
Yeah, so I would argue that it is the fact that they push empathy and that they really strive to humanize all of their characters and show these common threads that makes them unique in animated cinema, and really kind of goes to the heart of what Pixar is about, which is about, and we've talked about this before, like hope. If you can see the humanity in a villain, then maybe there's hope that there's no like distinct evil in this world, that everybody has an opportunity to you know, experience love, to give love, to, you know, experience friendship, to be a friend, to grow and become a better person. And I think that really goes to the heart of what Pixar is, and what, why I think that Pixar has endured over all these many years. As, you know, Lee mentioned, with drawbacks, with the times, you know, movies that they had that were maybe less successful and ones that were hits, that there's this kind of overarching theme, and that in each one of them, it's not just the protagonist that grows and that changes, which is very common in like traditional storytelling, but it's also the villains themselves that very often grow and change. And sometimes the protagonist is their own villain.
You gave me, I need to like be vulnerable right here. When you said hope, that I just got like goosebumps, because right, like I've obviously thought about villains and heroes and all that stuff, but then how then that all just really just ties all the way back in. And that message is hope is just so very powerful. So powerful.
Well, and possibly maybe that everybody's got a backstory, and that people should not think the worst of people when they're you don't know why someone it got to this point or this character got to this point. That's why it's good that Pixar sometimes gives you a backstory, like on
Otso Hugenberg,
because he has a big backstory. Gabby has a big backstory, and that helps us understand how they got to where they are.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just thinking about who the people that watch it, right? Of course, kids, adults, and just how this is such a very important message for everyone is just awesome.
Yeah. So that's kind of where I take that conversation about how they choose to develop their characters. I think is that it's really about continuing. How can we push this message of empathy and of humanizing each other? And at the same time, like seeing the humanity in ourselves, overcoming our own struggles. And I think Liberty had some good villains to bring up.
Oh yeah, I was saying that my favorites are Randall Boggs and Stinky Pete, again, who both have really interesting backstories. Stinky Pete just wanting to keep the gang together, and Randall, because of Monsters University, we get to know him a little more and see that he was just misunderstood initially and wanting acceptance, right? Like we all kind of do. So, yeah.
So Randall's a great character to bring up. Yeah. What do you think about how they did that? Do you think that was intentional? Do you think when they first wrote Monsters, Inc., that they already had that backstory for Randall in mind? Or do you think they decided after the fact that they needed to kind of, like Tara was saying, humanize him and, you know, mm-hmm. give a reason, a why behind the way he behaved, how he behaved?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure there's an answer with the team and the writers and the storytelling. But I think for me, when I first saw that after watching Monsters University, I felt like they needed, he was such an integral character, a significant character in Monsters, Inc., that maybe they wanted to legitimize sort of the villainness, the villain in him and with Mike and Sully. And that there was history there. So beyond just the fact that they worked at the same factory and they were coworkers, but they had grown up together. They had a collegiate history. I think that was really important to see for kids to see that the villain nature kind of developed over time in his envy of Sully, and his like legacy, right, at the university and his family. So I think that was my initial thinking. I would love to hear what everybody else thought in terms of why they made that creative choice.
My gut tells me that it was more developed after the success of the first film. And the reason for that is because in Monsters, Inc., I think Mike says something like, "You've been jealous of my looks since the third grade." And they haven't known each other since the third grade. And I forgot who, you know, fans asked. I don't know if it was the director, but they basically were like, "That's just an expression." And I was thinking, I don't think it's an expression. I think they just decided to change the story plot. Although I do love the direction they took it in, I don't know that it was like the initial thought when Monsters, Inc. was created.
I love that we just had two sides to the same coin there. That was great. What do we think the future looks like for Pixar? You know, the theories as far as like movies, maybe even what we think about stuff with parks. Karina, can you please talk with us about that?
Yeah. So first, I kind of just wanted to talk about Pixar's commitment to diversity and creative thinking and how I think that's going to progress in future films. To me, Pixar does a really amazing job at doing this right now. I recently watched Inside Pixar on Disney Plus. If anyone listening hasn't watched it, I definitely recommend it. That is probably one of my favorite things to come out of Disney Plus so far. But I watched that and it really shed some light on the moves that Pixar has made to become more inclusive in their storytelling and with their storytellers. My favorite episode was actually with Jessica Haidt, who is the script supervisor for Pixar. And she basically noticed a problem with gender representation in film, and she made a role for herself where she provides data analysis to executives on basically how represented males and females are on the screen. And with the help of another Pixarian, they made an automated tool. And now Jessica provides, you know, percentages of how many female versus male roles there are in the film, and then even how many speaking lines there are between the two genders. Soul ended up actually at about 50-50, but they said their goal isn't to have every film be 50-50. It's more so an aggregate. They want, you know, their studio to be known that they try to be as inclusive as possible. They still want to be able to, you know, authentically tell stories without constraints and percentages and things like that. But she actually noticed the disparity first. I believe she said in Cars 3, the early script was 90% male characters and lines. So she pointed out that male dominance in films is pretty commonplace. And it's so commonplace that we generally don't notice it because of how often we've seen it. So personally, I've never even noticed it. So that was really shocking to me. I might have noticed it in maybe like an action film or something, but definitely not in Pixar. I've always felt that they were very inclusive, but it really made me more aware of it since. And I've been looking at pretty much all movies so differently since then. So basically, Jessica just wanted to make a change and give viewers the chance to see someone more like themselves in a character, or just someone that represents someone like them in a movie. And I think just knowing that makes me feel more connected to recent Pixar movies and just looking at older films and seeing how they differ. And then they also have Britta Wilson on their team, who's the VP of Inclusion Strategies, and she focuses on finding people from diverse backgrounds to join their company and be part of the magic that goes on behind the scenes. She visits schools and works on recruiting students from various backgrounds. I think it's really important, and I really appreciate what they're doing, that they're trying to find a diverse team when they're trying to produce these equally diverse movies. So I think it's difficult to produce a diverse movie if the studio itself didn't, you know, participate in this inclusivity. So I think moving forward, we're going to see Pixar stick to this and even try to expand even more of these inclusive tactics into their everyday work life, like among their employees, but also on screen in their films. I'm also so impressed at the ways in which Pixar fosters creativity among their employees. Something that the animators do daily is show off what they're currently working on. And the goal is to get them past being embarrassed about unfinished work so they can get more creative as their animations progress. Pixar employees are also like encouraged to ask any department for advice on issues they're facing rather than having to go through all kinds of funnels of higher ups, things like that. They want people to open up and try to problem solve together. So something that seems to be a theme, and I definitely think it's working considering lots of their past successes, is just allowing their employees the freedom to test until they can get it right, test until they find a new, more creative solution. So I think Pixar is really good at developing an energy at the studio that allows people to basically be themselves. When people feel at peace in a workplace, they can be more creative. Ed Catmull said, "You get great creative people, you bet big on them, you give them enormous leeway and support, and you provide them with an environment in which they can get honest feedback from everyone." So basically, good leaders give their employees room to thrive and be comfortable with feedback, knowing that there is respect and, you know, positivity waiting for them on the other side. So I don't think this is something Pixar is ever going to abandon. This is something that they've basically stood by since the beginning and have just grown in those ideas. So I think they'll just continue to search for ways in which they can support and foster creativity within their walls. Recently, Pixar has also been doing a really great job of making films that share the beauty of a specific culture. Coco and Soul focus on Mexican and African-American cultures through animation, and I predict we'll see more films like that in the future. Luca is going to be released in June of this year, and that's set in the Italian Riviera. So that's another chance for us to see the depiction of a vibrant culture on screen. After the release of Soul, Pete Docter actually said that there are things in the pipeline that the public doesn't know about yet, projects with a diverse crew behind them that he feels will continue to surprise people, as these more recent movies have. He pointed out they're always trying to find new voices to tell their stories with. So if they continue on this path, I'm excited for the future of Pixar movies, you know, as they find new ways to embrace cultures around the world and show what the world truly looks like. And I also think, now that we have Pixar Pier in California Adventure, we'll be seeing a lot more adaptations of films through attractions, and then hopefully plusing older ones in the years to come. My only hope is maybe that we could get more immersive with them, like many other attractions offered around the resort are. Inside Out has become one of my favorite Pixar movies. And I just feel like Emotional Whirlwind didn't do that movie quite the justice that I wish it would have. But at the same time, I know we have space limitations, you know, at the Disneyland Resort that a lot of other parks don't. So I'm crossing my fingers that Imagineers somehow find somewhere to put a more immersive Pixar attraction. But in my head, you know, an Inside Out attraction would be something like the train of thought that leads you through Riley's mind and lets you visit each island of personality, something like that. Pixar is so good at creating worlds with levels and levels of details that just kind of get lost when it's a ride like Emotional Whirlwind or Incredicoaster. Like, the theming is absolutely there, but I don't think the immersion is up there as other attractions. For me, the best Pixar-related attraction is Toy Story Midway Mania. The tech in that attraction is interactive and entertaining. I think it's worth every minute of waiting in that queue. Well, I don't always feel the same way about maybe the other attractions on the pier. A really good example of the immersion that's possible is Toy Story Land at Walt Disney World. In that area of Hollywood Studios, you know, you're able to walk around and you're the size of toy. So there's such a deep level of detail in that universe that can transport guests when Imagineers have the landscape to do so. So my hope is, you know, with all that new cutting edge technology that Imagineers have been developing over the past few years, like Rise of Resistance, that those can be used to incorporate into future Pixar attractions in the way that other attractions are receiving. Aside from these hopes, I'm also thinking it would be really awesome if there was some plussing done to Monsters, Inc., Mike and Sully to the Rescue, since there is going to be that new Disney Plus series, Monsters at Work. It does still have Mike and Sully in it, but it would be really cool if they incorporated some of those new characters kind of in the way that they tweaked Pirates of the Caribbean as the films progressed. And as for removing attractions, I think Disney will just remove them possibly as they become more dated and replace them. I mean, I would love to think that Toy Story is eternal, and for all I know, maybe it is. As the younger generations grow up, there might be another Pixar movie that they really relate to, and possibly like something like Toy Story Land gets swapped to something else in the future, but for now, I will hope that that's not anytime soon. And I think the same goes for any attraction on Pixar Pier, except maybe the Incredicoaster. I can't imagine that going anywhere unless it was like a complete rehaul of Pixar Pier. It's just so all-encompassing on the pier in terms of landscape. But I could definitely see something like Emotional Whirlwind being taken down after some time to make way for something new. I mean, after all, Walt Disney said Disneyland's never complete, so I don't think we should ever be too comfortable with the way things look, because Imagineers are always tinkering and brainstorming new ways to bring magic to the parks.
Karina, you brought up, I'm embarrassed that I host a Disneyland podcast and I never connected that Pixar is obviously not as represented in the parks as our Disney movies are, but they really got the short end of the stick, because you're right. They've got attractions, but they are not immersive. We were talking about this in the chat while you were saying this. And the only attraction that the group could think of that is a truly immersive experience is Radiator Springs Racers, which we talked about earlier. Right. But you've got, like, I mean, maybe you could argue that the Astro Blasters are immersive, but we're not going to talk about them. They need a lot of love. But, you know, and same thing with Midway Mania. Like, it's only immersive because you're inside of a game, but it has really nothing to do with the characters and with the movies themselves.
Yeah, that's great.
And then same thing, too.
Maybe it connects to Toy Story 4 because,
maybe,
you know, in that film, they're in a carnival space, but it's not as transparent, I think, as Cars Land.
Right.
That's for sure, 100%. And I also, like, I still enjoy going on the Monsters, Inc. ride at DCA, but it's, like, too short for me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm right there with you, Karina. I want more.
Yeah, and cars are too small.
That's true.
I can barely fit in them.
Didn't at the end Roz used to like make comments to people in cars?
Yes.
And I could have sworn, unless it was just me the last couple of times, that she didn't say anything. And I was like, that was the most immersive part of the whole ride for me.
Oh no. I mean, I will say that the sets inside of the Monsters, Inc. attraction are beautiful. And, like, I just want to, like, reach out and pet Sully, which I won't. Don't worry. But I do. I mean, they are cool, but it's just not, it's just quite not the same level. Liberty, do you want to talk? You and I both got to experience Toy Story Land in Walt Disney World this year. Do you want to talk a bit about what that experience is like?
Yeah, so that was my very first time in Toy Story Land. And I would agree with your point you made earlier about the reason why it feels immersive is because you are dumped into a land that is specific to Toy Story and that Pixar film. So from the music and the characters and just like the just oversized displays of all of the toys around you, it's magical. And it's also, it brings out the child in you that I think is a different sort of like nostalgia and childhood memory that, is different from when you're in like Fantasyland, or Adventureland. But when you go into there and you start to recall the stories and the movie, like the feelings you got when you watched the films, the Pixar films, I think that's what's really special. Because you're then seeing images and like the design from the movies. You're essentially on like a set, a movie set, I think. So when I rode Slinky Dog Dash, I believe that's what it's called, for the first time, just the artwork was even childlike, the way that the drawings on the roller coaster walls and just like the makeup of the foundation of that roller coaster. All of the artwork was as if a child had, designed it, or not designed it, but like drawn all of the images. And that was really cool to see. And you're also greeted by the penguin. Is there a name for that
Wheezy.
Penguin? Wheezy. Yes. Wheezy. Yeah. At the end of the ride, I believe they're singing you on your way out. They're singing to you on your way out. So that was really cool to see too. It was like that engagement at the end of the ride was really cool. And I think it's so interesting though, because it's kind of tucked away in Hollywood Studios. And if you don't make your way out there, it's not like I don't know that it was like a premier spot for me to like go to, because as a first timer, it was on my list. But if you're just if you regularly go there, it doesn't seem like it would get a lot of visits because it's just kind of tucked away in the back. So yeah,
it is a little, well, Hollywood Studios in general is just not laid out the best in my opinion. And yeah, I think Toy Story Land has, it's a destination. You don't kind of accidentally stumble upon the land itself. All right. Well, thank you so much to all of our participants, Lee, Jill, Liberty, Tara, and of course, Karina. Thank you all for your time this evening. I love these because I always learn things and I love hearing other people's perspectives. So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, your knowledge, the history, everything. Just incredible. Your memories, your emotions, your feelings. It was a whirlwind, all of it. I loved it. So thank you everyone for your time. Listeners, if you enjoyed this, we did not get through everything on our very long list. I know we covered a lot, but we still have more to talk about. So please let us know if you'd like more Pixar or even Star Wars, Marvel, or any other topics for future roundtable discussions.
Cheers to a great day and this ice-cold Corona.
You know what would make this day even better? My grandma's carne asada.
Throw in some music.
We can watch the game. Or we could keep it simple.
Corona, la vida más fina. Get your Corona at ordercorona.com. Relax responsibly. Corona Extra Beer, imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.